The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why did Benjamin Franklin object to Congress designating the bald eagle as the official symbol of the United States?
Well, he thought that was a poor choice. He thought the wild turkey would be a lot better, though a little vain and silly, a bird of courage is the wild turkey. And he called the bald eagle is a bird of bad moral character. So bad moral character, they also flee from tiny mobbing songbirds. So they don't really exemplify the best in American behavior.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Kate Davis is my guest this time. She's a photographer who specializes in raptors, and she's the author of several books, including Raptors of the West, winner of a National Outdoor Book Award. Today we'll be talking about her latest book, Bald Eagle Nest, a story of survival in photographs. Bald Eagle Nest is a book in which more than 100 of your images capture the story of a pair of bald eagles and their four chicks. And this all takes place in a nest located, as you say, a 30-minute drive and a 10-minute walk from your house. But even though the nest was pretty close to where you live, it must have been a time-consuming and all-consuming project to get all these images. So just tell us how that worked. What was a typical day like?
The obsession.
Yes.
The obsession. I started photographing this nest in 2009, and they had three chicks, which I thought was pretty amazing. And in 2011, a neighbor spotted four little heads in April poking over the nest. And that's impossible. I'm sorry. I said, no, I don't believe you. And I showed up in April, very first day, pulled up. It had just snowed. The snow was just melting. And I put my tripod up and I got my camera ready. And in flies the male carrying a fish, the cover shot, 10 minutes into the first day. Then the obsession began. And I realized that documenting four chicks had never been done. There's only 12 nests in the world that have ever had four. And remarkably, six of those are in Montana. So that shows that we have a perfect habitat here. And these numbers have gone from 12 nests in the early, in the 70s, let's say, to over 600 bald eagle nests in the state of Montana. They're going up constantly, 10% a year. When will they plateau? And the numbers are increasing because these nests with three chicks are more common. Four, again, unheard of. It seems to be a fairly recent occurrence that four young actually make it to fledging or leaving the nest. But I just basically had my camera gear by the door. I'd get up in the morning, drive in, hike in, set up on the railroad track shooting into this nest. There's a highway, there's a housing development, the river's right there, you've got power lines over the top. So these chicks are used to noise, the adults as well. And I'd also been there quite a bit the last 2 years photographing the nest. So I just set up, and then I couldn't sit down, but I had a remote on my camera, and I just paced back and forth for about 4 to 5 hours at a pop. Sometimes 3 hours would go by, I wouldn't get a single image. Because, hey, two heads, big deal. Three heads, that's cool. But four chicks all standing up at once is what I was after. And it was so uncommon. The three chicks would be standing, you'd see the fourth head pop up, and the other one would go down. And so it became an obsession when, after 4 hours of nothing, all of a sudden, here's a fish delivery, a prey delivery by both adults. Bing, bang, 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 bang. You know, you get your motor drive going. So it was a combination between utter boredom and pure adrenaline rush.
These images are just absolutely spectacular. And I know you weren't out there with a $100 camera. What kind of equipment do you use?
I'm a Nikon girl. And I started by shooting a D700 with a 300 with a 1.4. So it's a 420. Got it?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
And anyway, I went to borrowlenses.com, which is a way that you can get these $8,000 camera lenses and rented a lens for a week. And that's when I got the series of the male flying in with that back half of a yearling deer and all four young standing up. And that was when, this was about halfway through nesting, and that's when I decided this is worthy of a book. This is really fun. So you need to have the good equipment. And I was also in a good spot photographing the birds. They were very cooperative quite often. What the story's about really is the amazing prey items that were arriving in the nest.
We'll get to the types of animals brought to the nest in a little while, but let's go back to just basic facts about eagles. They're federally protected and their populations are rising, but in the past they've been slaughtered, mostly, I think you mentioned, by the Alaska fishing and fur industry in the 50s was putting out bounties on them. Why would somebody want to kill eagles?
They were protecting their fish stock, they thought. But in the lower 48, the southern bald eagles were the ones that were really endangered. And this was all due to DDT. So it wasn't outright. You know, shooting was a problem, trapping was a problem. But DDT just prevented reproductive success. So if you can't recruit numbers into your population every year by having a successful nest and fledging at least two young, or even one, then the numbers just plummet. And in this state, there were 12 nests, and now over 600. So it was a bird that when I moved here, I hitchhiked all the way up to Glacier Park to see one, because that was when they had the Kokanee Salmon Run. And they had 500 to 700 in one spot that were all congregating. And now I guarantee you could just hang out on Higgins Avenue Bridge and see a bald eagle year-round. And so they're all over. We don't know when the carrying capacity will be reached. We think it's strictly a nesting site is the only thing that will limit their numbers or nesting sites. But they are territorial. They're not like ospreys that can nest right close to each other. So they do have their territory that they guard in an aggressive way. So now with these cottonwoods and ponderosa pines lining the waterways and they're becoming, I think, this is my guess, they're less wary of people than they used to be. They're more accustomed to being around people than in the past. And then that helps their reproductive strategies because, you know, they're around river waterways that are very popular for recreation, and it doesn't seem to affect them.
But the fishing industry, you write that they shouldn't really be worried because the eagles are usually taking sucker fish.
Mm-hmm.
Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, these are commercial fisheries in Alaska that actually had the bounty. And here they are taking a lot of suckers and squaw fish and, you know, those type of fish that we don't, that anglers don't target, like trout. So they basically scoop fish off and they don't plunge down after them like ospreys do.
The relationship between the ospreys and the eagles is a little contentious.
They hate each other. Yeah. The thing is, ospreys, their diet is 100%, okay, 99.9% live fish. And bald eagles will eat anything live or dead, as we see in this nest. And so it's essential that these ospreys are when the waters are high, like in 2011 when this nest was going on, they had to go up into high mountain lakes, the ospreys did. They had to go up into creeks where the water was clear. The water was mud, running mud, and you could not see down below in the surface where the fish were. So ospreys were at a real disadvantage. And having the bald eagle steal whatever fish they could get was unfair to me. So you're always rooting for the ospreys. At least I am. So that was a real problem for anything that eats fish during the spring runoff of 2011. And that's when we saw the bald eagles bringing in just about anything but fish. But bald eagles, I have seen them stoop out of the sky to attack ospreys and vice versa. So There's a battle sequence in the book, too, that happened right over my head. They hate each other.
Well, let's go back to the nest. You know, you think of a bird nest, but this is more like a tree house, it looks like to me. It's huge.
Yeah. This nest was 10, I think it was 10 years old by the time I was up there photographing it. And they add to it every year. It's a courtship thing. Hey, honey, here's some sticks. You arrange them for me. And so they add to it. They repair it. And they'll start repairing it even in the winter. You know, these guys are early breeders, bald eagles are. So this nest just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's huge. It's about 75 feet up in a ponderosa pine that has a canopy of limbs over the top, so it's shaded, which is a real advantage. I've seen a lot of bald eagle nests that are out in the open, and so the parents are constantly shading the young. These guys have it made.
And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, you said the nest was maybe 3 feet by 8 feet, like 3 feet deep by about 8 feet wide.
Yeah, that's about right.
And you wrote about them bringing stuff up from the nest, like parts of animals.
Yeah. They just, you know, you'd be seeing, see them standing there, and then one will reach down, and here comes a duck's head, you know? Or maybe like a deer leg poking out over the edge with its little hooves pointing in the air, you know? Or these young were well fed. And I imagine the smell up there and probably the flies and everything, but they didn't seem to discard things over the edge. It kind of just kept them right there. And it made for lots of play toys, a young tugging at squirrel legs, for example. Or one eagle spent about an hour trying to swallow an entire white-tailed deer tail. One of the things that I found amazing was some of the neighbors here, their ducks down, swimming down below. Well, here they come bringing in ducks. And this is all during the high water. Pigeons hang out over there on the railroad tracks. Now, how does a giant bald eagle catch a pigeon with that maneuverability in the air that they have? My absolute favorite is I got a photograph of the male bald eagle standing on the snag with an European starling standing next to him. So it's called American Eagle, European Starling. And, of course, these starlings, there are 200 million of them in North America, coast to coast, a real pest. And then the very next page, you see him flying in, holding a starling. He's caught a starling or gotten one somehow. And the caption says, "One fewer European starling in the world thanks to the male bald eagle." It's surprising to see them bringing that in. Then there's a golf course about a half a mile away, and they would bring in Canada goose goslings that they were just plucking off the fairways. A friend of mine was golfing over there, and he said one of the bald eagles flew down and grabbed his golf ball as it was bouncing down the fairway one time. So that was sort of a smorgasbord.
I thought it was a baby rabbit or something.
Who knows? It's just, you know, hey, that looks good. Let's grab that, you know. And so we've got everything from starlings, pigeons, ducks, and then these Canada geese. And then one of the surprising things is we know they eat carrion. We know they eat roadkill. Well, they were bringing in squirrels that did not look flattened in any way. They looked like they caught these things. And these are eastern fox squirrels and Colombian ground squirrels. And that was most of their diet for the really high water, squirrel after squirrel after squirrel coming in the nest. And these looked like they were catching them, and they would bring them in and carefully, all four young would politely eat. "No, you eat. No, I've already eaten. Oh, please, 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 you eat. I'm not making this up. I've never seen such a polite family." And I'm putting human emotions in here, but they just weren't competitive. They were well fed. These birds were well fed by both adults. And so the squirrels were just, you'd see squirrel tails and squirrel legs poking out everywhere. And then one day I noticed there's, what is that? There's a little activity down below. There was a family of eastern fox squirrels lived in the nest with the young, with the bald eagles. And you just see them poke their little head out. And you're thinking, well, wait a minute. These guys are living on the edge here, right? But the young aren't about to catch them. And anytime the adult would fly in, they would disappear. So we had a family of squirrels living in there. We had magpies living all around, ducks underneath, all these prey items that would show up. A huge neighborhood there on the Clark Fork River.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with award-winning photographer and author Kate Davis about her book, Bald Eagle Nest. We'll be right back to talk more right after a short break. Stick around. There's also a sequence of images in the book that tells a story of two deer, one that was draped over a power line that caused a power outage, but then there was another series of photos that showed the eagles had killed a doe's fawn, and then she kept trying to get back to her baby, and of course the eagles are there just ripping it to shreds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that was amazing, and that story, they called it the flying deer, was one of the eagles was bringing this fawn back, and the friend of mine, Ryan Gibbs from Northwestern Energy, climbed up and pulled that down, and he reported that it had the long bones in the leg and the skull and the spine, and that's it. Everything else was gone. So did they kill the fawn? Who knows? Was it a roadkill that they ate? And we're bringing it back, or did a coyote get it? We don't know, but the eagle dropped this deer on the power line, and it shorted out all that. It went swinging over, touched another power line, and all the electrical outage in town in East Missoula lasted for over an hour. And there were all these jokes about the deer with wings and the flying deer and Santa Claus's stray reindeer and all this. But it was the eagles, and they were just doing their job. So now we know that the fawns are part of their diet when we actually witnessed them. I didn't see the female kill the fawn, but I saw her trying to drag it up on a stump. And the doe was stomping her feet and charging up and getting within 20 feet and flicking her tail. And then finally she gave up. The female was bringing little parts of the fawn up to the nest, and it was just right across the river. There's one image where the young are kind of peering down, and there's the mom and the fawn and the doe all in one shot. So it was pretty amazing to see that. It didn't look like a newborn either. It was an older fawn. So they're doing pretty well. What we think of as carrion-eating thieves were really doing a good job.
I was surprised to find out that their heads don't turn white for a long time.
Yeah, that's their little badge that they're old enough to breed. So they have all these intermediate grays, and for a while there, they have a gray head with a black stripe. They look like an osprey. Then they have a gray head with a grayish tail with a black tip. And then finally at 6 years old, bang, they have the badge that they're old enough to breed. And they'll breed for a long time. I mean, they have a long lifespan, over 20 years in the wild. So they can afford to have two or three young a year, which is normal. Usually the third young. These birds are the example of fratricide or Cain and Abelism, where if in the course of the spring, if the food supply were to drop for some reason, that youngest bird is dead, or they'll kill him outright, or they'll push him out of the nest. And so they're kind of ensuring that at least the oldest two or the fittest two are going to survive and fledge. In this case, four survived and fledged. And I would not have believed it. I would have thought the youngest one would have been killed by the older. And being as the eggs hatch several days apart, there is a size difference. You can tell the oldest from the youngest up until, you know, way into nesting. And so there's this size difference. And we would see the oldest three stand around while the adult fed the youngest. I mean, it was just, I couldn't believe it. So our example of one bird being killed out of the nest of three, and in this case four, didn't happen. All four fledged, all four left the nest.
And you watched these young birds for weeks or months after they left the nest, and you have some great shots of them trying to fly and sometimes not being very successful.
No. They know how to fly. They just don't know how to land. That is true. And we're talking these great, big, heavy, giant. I mean, they're bigger than their parents when they leave the nest. And as they molt, their feathers will get shorter. But these are giant birds. They're doing their very first flights out of the nest. I watched a few of them, their very first flights, flying right across in a nice, big, strong flight, whack, right into the side of the hill. They don't even put on the brakes. So, yeah, the landing part was tough for them. And I think it's fun to see how pretty soon the parent birds were always there somewhere. You know, if they weren't right at the nest, just look around. You'd get this feeling you were being watched. They were over across the river. They were over here in this snag. They really kept a good watch on that nest. And after a while, you know, these young are begging to be fed, begging, 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 begging for months and months and months. The parents are feeding them. So by the time they leave the nest, they don't have any predators. They're great big birds. The only problem they might have is what happened to one of them. It was struck by a vehicle on the highway. And electrocution's a problem, these type of things. But in the wild, they really don't have any natural predators when they're this big. They're huge. So.
And the one that was struck by a vehicle on the highway went to rehab but didn't make it,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's part of that's the life of a raptor. That's the first year of a raptor, is that they have such a hard time and a hard life that about 60% of them die the first year, even without cars and power lines. So if they all survived, the world would be overrun, right? We'd have 50 million robins, you know, every spring. So that's all a part of it, is the mortality of first-year birds. And in the case of raptors, it's very high. It's, 60, sometimes 70% for birds that have to find, catch, and kill other animals. It's hard.
So choose one photograph in the book that we haven't talked about and tell me why it's one of your favorites.
Well, I was down at the river, and one of the females are larger. This bird had left the nest several weeks before. She was very confident. She could fly and land. And you know, you could just see she was more at ease getting around. And she landed up in the scenic snag. And I call it the scenic snag. It's where they all leave the nest. They all go right over there first. And the parent birds are standing there all the time. And we have these orioles, an oriole family, a Bullock's oriole family that lives there. These birds are tiny. They weigh 37 grams. And this female, the female that had left the nest that was confident, the orioles were just, they would attack her all the time. I got a whole sequence of where they're bouncing off her. And she kind of looks a little bit irritated and goes, well, I think I'll just go away. I'll just fly across the river. And she kind of yawned and flew away for a nice, calm place to go soak up the sun. And then finally, I see that the youngest bird is finally ready to leave the nest. This is at 12 weeks. He's doing his very first flight, flies over to the scenic snag. In come the orioles. He is absolutely in terror, freaked out. Oh my God, he can't figure out how to perch. So just in absolute terror, he flees. He flies through the top of a cottonwood tree, and he gets a limb stuck in his mouth, a little cottonwood limb stuck in his mouth. And he's flying right overhead. And I had to go back and look at all these images to figure out what I had just witnessed. But that female Bullock's oriole is chasing him like a bullet, like, get away. Bouncing off his back. And I watch this bird, and he's so scared of this little tiny songbird that he's reaching with first his left foot, then his right foot, then his left foot to try to dislodge this limb out of his mouth. And he absolutely cannot figure out. All he has to do is open his mouth, right? But he's so scared, and he finally just, the limb falls down. He goes down, he stands in the Clark Fork, and he just does this rouse. We call it a rouse, where they shake their feathers, takes a nice long drink, and he goes, man, it's a jungle out there.
And So Benjamin Franklin, who pointed out that eagles often flee from
mobbing songbirds. There's our sample. And it really does happen. I think it's just, if I was a 37-gram Bullock's Oriole, I think I would chase these big guys too, just to see this reaction. It's just amazing. All summer, even after nesting, why they were doing that, just perhaps, I don't know, just because they can. But that was kind of a fun sequence. And then I entered it in the Audubon photo contest for last year, and it won top 100. But nobody, if you look at it, you go, what is that? Is that a bald eagle? Huh? Is that an oriole? Huh? Is that a limb stuck in his mouth? You know? So you definitely need to hear the story. You can't just look at the image and go, wow, huh? But these orioles were brave. Brave. Fearless, I guess, is a better word. It's pretty cool.
Or driven or something.
Yeah.
Because as you said, that one looked like a bullet just going after the eagle. I mean, exactly. Wings tucked in, legs pulled in.
And they just, they flap it and they just come in and they just, but literally bouncing off this bird. And I had to shoot a really fast shutter speed, about 2,500 or 3,200 of a second, just to catch this. Because, you know, you just learn, you learn your camera when you're standing there for 200 hours waiting for something to happen. And I didn't think I could actually put in that those kind of hours. But when you come home and you get the image that you were hoping to get, a behavior that maybe isn't recorded before, bringing in a starling, I don't think anybody would believe that these guys would catch starlings. The deer, the back half of a yearling deer with the pelvis and the two legs that the male brought in. It took him, it was a laborious flight. He went around the nest and around and plopped it in the nest for him. After that, the female brought in both the other legs. So pretty soon we had four deer legs in the nest. You know, that kind of reward at the end of the day, I my poor husband, he'd hear me, Tom, I think I got the shot of a lifetime. And after a while, it's just crying wolf. He's like, yeah, sure.
Again. You got the shot of a lifetime.
No, this is it, Tom. This is it. This is the shot of a lifetime. I don't really care if you're a bird watcher or ornithologist or zoologist, but God, you notice bald eagles. I mean, you can't not just be driving down the road and not take a second glance at a bald eagle. I mean, they're so impressive. And for whatever reason, American Eagle or patriotism or whatever, I find people really have a connection with this species, and that's why I'm so happy to have this book out now.
Yeah, the eagle obviously was chosen as the official symbol of the United States for its looks.
Yeah, not its behavior, I guess, huh?
Right.
Yeah. Got some more carrion coming in, honey?
Kate Davis is founder of Raptors of the Rockies, which is an educational nonprofit organization, and she's the current conference chair of the Raptor Research Foundation. You'll find lots more information about her, as well as links to some of her spectacular photographs at therightquestion.blogspot.com. That's right with a W.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Osteen, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.